Hey, welcome to the second episode of The Delta on Amplify, hosted by Hermes Investment Management. It's the 2nd of May, 2019. And just to give you some context, since the last episode, we've seen really a consolidation in markets. We're sitting at around 250 on iTraxx Crossover, which is, as you know, our European high yield benchmark index. Markets have continued to rally, but more the stuff that was really left behind catching up. So we're seeing that final phase. On this month's episode, we are with Tommaso and Filippo, our two Italian members of the team. They're going to make the bull and bear case. They were uniquely representative of that bull and bear case, and it won't take you long to guess who is who in that regard. So I'm going to start with Tommaso, and I'm going to ask Tommaso to give us a little bit of context in terms of where we are markets-wise, and to talk about where he thinks we are in terms of the sort of macro cycle that we're going through here, as well as maybe a few little summary remarks about this mini cycle we've just experienced. So Tommaso, welcome. Let's hand over to you. You can give us a little bit of a backdrop.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to be clear, I'm on the bearish camp. I really think we are at the end of this market cycle, perhaps even past it. For a number of reasons, I'm just going to quote some of them, but the convergence of extremely favorable events that extend in this cycle are gone or fading. For example, the synchronization of monetary policy, the synchronization of global growth, the U.S. stimulus are all things that are fading or gone. Growth and inflation are trending down globally. Global growth peaked in March of last year. Inflation peaked in October of last year. If you look at the Citi Economic Surprise Index, which measured the extent of which economic data beats or miss expectations, on the developed market side, we have consistently missed expectations since March of last year. US was the bright spot, and since February of this year, I started to disappoint as well. The same on EM, despite some recent positive data from China. If you look again at the US, the Consumer Confidence Index peaked in September. The component that looks at where we are now, the confidence about on consumers, where we are now, has bounced, but the expectation for the futures have not yet. The US yield curve is a topic that has been broadly touched by most operators in the market, but basically inverted at the beginning of the year. We believe it's a very powerful signal, especially in the context of quantitative tightening. And on average, the inversion precedes a recession by 5 months. Now, of course, it's an average. It's not always like that. And finally, and I think that's, in my mind, one of the most important points, is that the Powell statement in January 4th marks the end of this tightening cycle. And we are basically at 2.5%. The cycle stopped, the tightening cycle stopped in 2007 at 5.25, and in 2000 at 6.5. And basically, this is an economy that cannot stand rates higher than 2.5%. I think that's a very telling sign. Historically, the end of the tightening cycle precedes a recession by about a year.
So, Tommaso, just before you move on there, maybe a couple of things that I'd like you to expand on a little. First, you said it's the yield curve inverting is a powerful signal, especially amidst quantitative tightening. Maybe you can talk to us about why you think it's especially important in a tightening cycle.
Well, basically, what has happened since the Fed started reducing its balance sheet is that there is one more operator that is essentially selling treasury, or certainly not buying them and letting them run off. So the fact that there is one of the most powerful buyer in government bonds generally has been central bank, and the fact that one of the biggest central bank in the world has stopped buying treasuries, and yet yields have come down on the medium to long end, means that there is a significant appetite by normal operators to buy the curve, to buy bonds, to buy safety assets. And again, that in my mind reinforces the signal of the inversion.
Yeah, I think it would be hard to argue with that. But we are seeing a sort of slightly bipolar behavior pattern here, aren't we? In that you can see the signals from that yield curve, but you can also just look at anything that's happened in equity land and see that actually people don't feel particularly conservative there, which is where I come back to the last point you were making about the tightening cycle ending because the Fed couldn't cope with tightening any further and the market couldn't react to it. But the Fed did listen, and the Fed listened sufficiently that it looks like we're on pause almost indefinitely.
Absolutely. And that was clearly a big turn of event when Powell essentially announced the change of policy for the Fed. There was another event that was particularly telling in my mind is when the Treasury Secretary Mnuchin over the weekend spoke with the CEO of the larger bank in the U.S. I think it was December 22nd, and then reassured the market that the liquidity was fine. So in my mind, just the speed at which the Fed changed its tone, and you know the fact that Mnuchin felt the need to go and check the liquidity with the banks and reassure the market, is sort of an indication that authorities saw the market as very fragile. Now, what has happened since is basically investors saw the turn in the Fed as the green light to apply the same playbook that they have in the last 10 years. And which is essentially buy on central bank support. And so what we can see on our hand is that we can sort of proxy systematic strategies, and they've basically re-risked 60% of what they were at the top in September of last year. And discretionary accounts are a bit lagging, but basically the market is back in, applying the same rule book. Meanwhile, the global excess liquidity is below long-term average, and the trend, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, the trend in growth and inflation is lower. So basically what we think is that the market is now far ahead of the curve in terms of it's technically vulnerable and to disappointing news. My base case is that we'll experience a recession, probably a shallow one, at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020. And this would be a cause to reduce some of the excess in terms of capacity, debt load, et cetera, et cetera. From there on, I can see a scenario where we go back to the standard, growth inflation cycles that we had in the past. And especially now that we are talking about MMT, which is... to some extent, it's a scary theory, but so that said, if we continue on this current path where we see lower highs in policy rate and lower lows, and a system that keeps creating leverage, I think the trend is very clear towards the Japanification of the developed economies.
And I think this is the point at which we should turn to Filippo, because I can see him frothing at the mouth at the mention of the word Japanification. And maybe, Filippo, you can talk to me about the counter-arguments that you see to that perspective.
Yeah, sure. I think Tommaso inadvertently devalued his own argument between the lines, in the sense that he make a stark difference from the... dialectics of Chairman Powell between the 4th of December 2018, so last year, and this year, the 4th of January 2019, which essentially between the lines, the Fed was saying we were wrong back in December. And I think also this is quite a signal, important signal, which has been picked up by the market. And just parking aside the miscommunication by the U.S. Treasury Secretary before Christmas about the liquidity of the banks, which is very strong, I think the market has been applying the same rule book as in the last 10 years, because, that's the way it should be doing. And so if you look at the return in the first quarter, that's quite a telling story. To be fair, We think, I personally think we're in the late cycle as opposed to the end of the cycle, but we can endlessly debate at this point. And I think that it's possible that we have lower growth and lower inflation everywhere on this planet, but that I don't think it is necessary a bad news. Maybe it's a bad news over if you take a 10-20 year view, but I think also in the current market is not a bad thing. And maybe I will comment later on if we've gone too far or not, because for example I look at global financial, and if you look especially at the European financial and the subordinate part of the capital, on my data as of today, 2nd of May 2019, we retrace 60% of the widening in terms of euro dollar in the 81 asset class, which is the lower part of the capital structure in European banks, and about 57.5 in sterling 81. So we've gone a long way, but we haven't really covered the entire loss ground for a number of reasons. And as Tommaso very eloquently explained, the problem we had in 2018, they're still there in 2019, the never-ending US-China dispute and the effect it's having on global trade, the dollar strength, so which is something we saw in the first part of 2018 and it's now reappearing, and of course, I mean, Italy, Brexit, you name it, so they're all still there. But I think also the market has taken a more, practical approach to those issues on the table, because they see a path from here. And maybe it's not a path of increasing, capital appreciation, especially in the fixed income security, but I think it's a path of nice carry. And I think also that's also based on some fundamental consideration. If you look at the, lots has been written and lots of ink has been spent on how global banks are very different from where they were in before the crisis. I mean, if you only just have to look at the liquidity when we had the on a global loan-to-deposit ratio well north of 100%, typically in the 115-125 range, say that the banks are so very reliant on the wholesale market because they had a so-called funding gap. And I think this gap has all but disappeared, even in Europe, in some jurisdiction. On the issue of the Japanification, I think it's made for great TV and great headline, but I think if you look deep into it, then it's not really happening in the sense that in America, the banks are local monopolies, so they're actually quite big owner of pricing power in local markets, both the money center banks, also the top six bank, and the regional banks in some state bank. And in Europe, I mean, we've been coping, some jurisdictions have already been coping with negative rates. Think of Switzerland since year-end 2015 on the Nordics market. You can think of Norway, Sweden, to some extent also Denmark. And that hasn't really precluded those banks to achieve return on equity in some cases north of 10%. If I can wrap up in terms of cross assets, I think also the current juncture is moderate positive for bank equity, but actually it could be very positive for bank credit, because essentially the banks are accruing capital, not so much for shareholders. If you see that, so the very few and far between example of capital return to the shareholder, but they're more accruing capital for bondholder and regulator. And I think it's not a bad environment to be in.
Okay, so if I can try and bridge the gap between the two of you on the Japanification argument, I would concede definitively to Tommaso that in the sense that markets are driving policies, rates, decisions, I think we concede that element of Japanification has been evidenced and looks likely to continue both in Europe and in the US. But some of the stuff below the surface, you're challenging, Filippo, in that, you know, financial institutions appear to be close to fully functional again, and that you look across some of the assets that you're investing in and you like them on a sort of long-term fundamental basis, whereas the argument would be that people are just buying stuff in Japan because they have to.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe
if I can come back on the Japanification argument, just very briefly, I think is my observation is that it has less to do with the economic makeup of an economy. It's more a function of a broader set of factors. And the three key factors I see is the aging of the population, the level of state interventionism in the economy, and a cultural factor. Now, the first two factors are global phenomenon across the M, and the aging of the population is also impacting China. The third factor is a cultural one, and that's perhaps where I can agree with Filippo that the U.S. may be the only bright spot, because it's the only large economy where failure is seen as an integral part of success and cherished as an experience. But in Europe, in Japan, in China, I think the extend and pretend attitude is going to be the norm, and probably even more so if the U.K. leaves the Europe. So in my mind, Japanification in Europe is almost inevitable. That doesn't mean that it's a doomed scenario. I mean, Japan has shown that people can live a good life in a shrinking or weakening economy.
Yeah, I mean, they're powerful points. I'm a pretty miserable guy by nature, and I certainly hear everything that you're saying. But there is another counter, and it's not to do with Japanification, but it's certainly impacting everything that we look at in fixed income markets, which is that we've got more than 10 trillions worth of assets that are negative yielding. And that makes structuring within credit markets, makes structuring within equity markets necessary in order to drive returns further and further, because people have liabilities that they need to service. They need to be making the 5, 6, 7% returns. And it's getting harder and harder to do that when the E isn't giving it to you. So you have to do it through the S. Okay, and this is the point at which we come to all options on the table, where questions are sent in by clients and we respond to them. The question that we've received this time is, how much risk should clients be taking at this point in the cycle, and how should they be managing their portfolios in that regard?
The one thing that we have spent a lot of time on in the last couple of years is to find strategies or assets that can replace the use that government bond had in our portfolios, because we think that now that they're yielding 2.5 or 3%, they're never going to give the same punch that that they used to give when they were yielding 5%. And so we have created or selected a number of strategies, whether it's in commodity curve trades or in value versus growth and mean reversion strategy, that are there in the portfolio to essentially recreate that that safety net that we may not get from government bond anymore. So find ways to get long volatility without bleeding carry. I guess that will sum it up.
It's the holy grail. And you, Filippo?
Well, if you look at our portfolio, I think they are very global, and I think also there are some sectors, even though the great performance in Q1 are actually quite still interesting. Just giving a few examples, I think the U.S. House builder is a very good sector, especially with all the consideration around next move for the U.S. rate, especially the 30-year. And which is very important for mortgage pricing. I think Brazil is still a very good place to be. I mean, it's an extraordinary second half of 2018, and 2019 is actually it's shaping up very, very well, crossing fingers. And then also, as I say, some barbell strategy in European financial actually could serve very well your purpose this year.
So one of the things that we ask our guests to do is to come with a fascinating factoid for listeners to take away. Given that Tommaso has already covered us with a series of interesting facts, let's just close with Filippo giving us a fascinating fact from his part of markets.
Yeah, and actually it's quite interesting because, for example, the Eurozone bank has so much malign the market. But in fact, so if you look at the equity market is telling a slightly different story. And if you check your numbers, since 2010, so before the Greek crisis, there's been eight periods of 15% plus relative performance of Eurozone bank stocks.
Thank you very much, guys. I'm going to close with my thoughts. I think given where we are in markets, you have to really try and challenge yourself to find stuff that you'd be happy to be short. Being short anything has been an absolute nightmare for the first 4 months of this year. We had a conversation about what it would have felt like to have been short Deutsche Bank over the last 4 months. I think there are trades in the belly of indices, both high yield in Europe and the US, but also in investment grade space that look to be trading way too tight in a historical context. And if you can find ways to fund being short that part of the fixed income markets, I think that's another way to express exactly the view that Tommaso was describing. I think you're buying volatility if you're getting short some of those names, because I think when a bigger correction comes, as we saw in the fourth quarter of last year, those names are likely to outperform on the widening. Thank you very much, listeners. Look forward to speaking to you next time, where I will have a slightly wider group of individuals coming and chatting to me about a slightly less fixed income related topic. So I look forward to speaking to you in a month. Thank you very much. And that was The Delta, Episode 2.
Thank you for listening to the Hermes podcast. If you found it interesting and would like to listen to more podcasts by Hermes, please visit our website, hermes-investment.com, and search for podcasts. These podcasts are for information purposes only, and the views, information, or opinions expressed therein are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Hermes Investment Management and its employees. Performance should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All the performance represented is historical. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results, and investors may not recover the full amount invested.